Public lecture series of John Shishrama, Graduate School of Public Policy. My name's Greg Pelzer, and I'm part of my appointment is here at the school, and I'm kind of helping out with Ken Coates, who's been organizing on this front, my partner in crime for about 20 years here. But today we're very honored to have a presentation today by Chief Perry Bellegard, who probably everyone knows here is the Chief of the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. And there is no more important topic facing this province and arguably even this country than the place of First Nations and Métis peoples in our country and in our province. And we're in the midst, obviously, as everyone knows, anyone who's been in this province for the last 10 years, in terms of unprecedented growth, in terms of the resource sector. And these two things come together, and that's going to define the future of our province, how well we're going to be, and how we're going to succeed as a province, as you've all heard before many a times, anyone's paying attention, that we're all treaty peoples. And what does that really mean? A little bit about Chief Bellegard. Chief Bellegard is one of the most able politicians, most able political leaders in this country. He's also one of the most able politicians and able First Nations leaders in this province and in this country. Chief Bellegard's been involved in Aboriginal politics, First Nations politics, for almost 30 years now, from the time he graduated from university. He's been a former chief of his First Nation, the Black Bear First Nation. He's been involved in tribal council politics with Touchwood File Hills, Capel, FA, which are now just now after Touchwood left. It's all FHQers on that side. But there's and then been a regional chief for the Assembly of First Nations and also vice president of Labor and Agricultural Aboriginal Initiatives with the Crown Investment Corporation of Saskatchewan. And I know Perry, Chief Bellegard, from the times we worked on First Nations University file. And I can attest in terms of somebody with huge passion, huge integrity, and a commitment, not only for the place of First Nations people in this province, but for all people in the betterment of Saskatchewan. And to witness that firsthand was quite an honor to work with Chief Bellegard. Before we invite Chief Bellegard to speak with us today, I do have some acknowledgments that I've been asked to pass along. And one is Deputy Minister Lynn Gallagher from Saskatchewan Parks, Culture and Sport. And Senator Lillian Dick from Senate of Canada, one of our own Saskatchewan senators. President of the USSU, Max Findate. And Director of General Operations, Doug Zielinski, with Western Economic Diversification of Canada. And without further ado, Chief Bellegard.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Greg, for that kind introduction, and say good afternoon to you all, friends and relatives. I'm standing at the U of S in Treaty 6 territory, but I also see people down in Regina in Treaty 4 territory. So I'll say hello to people down there as well. And so I'm going to be looking at the camera so we have some contact to the people down there as well. And this afternoon, I'm going to be talking about what's up here on the slide, First Nations and the province's resource future, the path to economic certainty. But I, for one, I'm talking to why I decided to come here to talk to the students and people here is because this line here, preparing the next generation of leaders. And I've always said this line, you don't have to be elected to be a leader. You do not have to be elected to be a leader. And so I really wanted to take the opportunity to come and hopefully shape your minds and your thoughts, you know, because you're going to be policymakers, lawmakers. You're going to be developing frameworks for not only Government of Saskatchewan, different governments across Canada, and also becoming heads of institutions and presidents and CEOs. So this is really prime time. So I wanted to take this opportunity to come to talk to you and share with you from a First Nations perspective, from a First Nations point of view. You know, when even the Premier and I get into dialogues about resource registration, what does that mean? Is it a lawful political promise or what is it? You know, and why we need to engage in it, that it's good for everybody, that it creates economic certainty. If we can get our heads around that. So I really welcome the opportunity to do that here. At the U of S and the U of R and the schools that are doing this positive thing. I also want to acknowledge as well the Senator for being here. Always good to see her. She's such a strong advocate for positive change locally, regionally, nationally. And just thank you for your work, Senator Lillian. And to, as well, I will say, Max Findlay, first time First Nations person becoming president of the University Students Association. So I'll acknowledge that. And the Deputy Minister that's here, where's the Deputy Minister? I want to see who that is.
Regina.
Oh, she's in Regina. Sorry. Wave your hand in Regina. Deputy Minister, I want to acknowledge you. Well, she may not be in the room, but anyway, I acknowledge just with everybody here. So I had lunch with Ken and Greg and over lunchtime. It became apparent to me that I don't want to make the assumption that you all know how we're structured as First Nations people, you know. So I want to spend a little bit of time, or even, what should we call them? You ever go, like I spent 3 or 4 years at Crown Investments Corporation of Saskatchewan. You know, and then sometimes around the coffee room and the water cooler here, what should we call them? what should we call them? You know, how should you refer to us, you know, as Indigenous peoples or Native people, Aboriginal people, First Nations people, Métis people, on-reserve people, off-reserve people, status Indians, non-status Indians, what is it, you know? So I'm going to get a little bit into that as well, you know, because if you're going to be framing public policy, you know, what's the right term, or how should it be, you know? So we're going to spend some time with that. And I like to also have fun, you know, and I'm not going to make any crazy jokes or anything, but I just want to be able to have fun and laugh, you know, as well, because you learn better, you know, you learn better. So my first couple of points before going to the formal presentation is to get you all comfortable with how we're structured here in this territory now called Saskatchewan. You know, so I always use Little Black Bear first. And I should have, in my next presentations, I will have a slide that depicts how we're set up or structured. Because you ever wonder, what do they mean, Indian self-government? What does that mean? What does that look like? What are they talking about, jurisdiction? You know, so for me, I always put the Creator on top. You know, and I always say there's many roads to that Creator. I hope we all get on one sometime, you know. There's many roads there, but the Creator's on top. And then we go to the people, our people, you know. And then from the people, we select a leader. I'm going to use Little Black Bear, my home reserve. The people will select a chief and council, okay. So a chief and council, you know, that's our first order of government, selected by the people. Because of a recent Supreme Court of Canada decision called the Corbière decision, everybody has the right to vote for the chief and council now, you know. So our chiefs represent all their people because of that decision. So first order of government, Little Black Bear, chief and council. That's one. Little Black Bear belongs to a thing called an agency, the File Hills Agency. Okay, and the agency is made up of 5 reservations. Oconee, Star Blanket, Little Black Bear, Papeksies, and we also include Carry the Kettle for police services. We have a standalone police service at File Hills, you know. So we belong to an agency, okay? 5 First Nations make up an agency. Then we also belong to a thing called a tribal council, okay? At one time it was Touchwood, File Hills, Capel Tribal Council, Craig. You know, it made up of 16 First Nations that made up the tribal council. But now today in 2014, It's File Hills Coppell Tribal Council. There's 11 reserves that are part of that. Then Little Black Bear Game belongs to an organization that's been around for 65 years in this province called the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations. So we go from the reserve to an agency, to a tribal council, to an FSIN. We also belong to a thing called the Assembly of First Nations. 633 reserves in Canada, right? So you look at a structure there. But you notice how I went from the creator to the people to the chief and council, then all these other things underneath. Because some people think the AFN's on top. Some people think the FSIN's on top. We're not. How I described it, we're on the bottom. Then we also say, Little Black Bear entered into treaty in 1874, September 15th, at Fort Coppell, Saskatchewan. So Little Black Bear, and I'll make another little diagram across, and put Little Black Bear entered into treaty, treaty number 4. Okay? That's across now. So I went this way on this one side. Now I'm going over this way now. Little Black Bear, Treaty 4. Okay? If you're from Palmaker, you go Palmaker, Treaty 6. You know? If you're from Ritter, Shoal Lake, Ritterth, Shoal Lake, Treaty 5. You know? If you're further north, Treaty 10. So it depends. But for Little Black Bear, Treaty number 4. And then under Treaty 4, Little Black Bear Game. What nation are we? Are we Cree? Are we Ojibwe? Are we Dene? Are we Dakota? Are we Lakota? Are we Nakota? You know, so we've been still mixed up because of Bill C-31. We said we're the Cree Assiniboine tribe. Because we're mixed, but we're Cree, part of the Nehiyawak peoples. Okay? So there's your model. Like if you had it on chart. So in terms of governance now, in terms of self-determination, when I start these talks, I always say Little Black Bear exercised his inherent right to self-determination. Because again, we had our own land, our own laws, our own languages, our own identifiable forms of government, our people. You know, so things that qualify for the inherent right to self-determination. That's all he did by entering into that treaty. Okay, so that's our governance structure. So when we start, and this is not a self-determination, self-government class, we're going to get to resource revenue share, but I wanted to show you and demonstrate in Canada what we have as Indigenous people. So from Little Black Bear, that's one reserve. Belongs to an agency, that's 5 reserves. Belongs to a tribal council, there's 11 reserves. You know, and there's an election at the chief and council level. There's also an election at the tribal council level. You know, when the chiefs and councils get together to elect a tribal chief, you know, and then you also have an election at the FSIN level, where every 3 years, all the set, and there's 74 reserves in Saskatchewan, okay? And then we belong to the Assembly of First Nations, 633 reserves, 633 chiefs across Canada. So that's the structure we have, okay? That's what we belong to as Little Black Bear One Reserve. And then we belong to Treaty Number 4, and we're part of the Cree Nation. So in Saskatchewan, the 74 First Nations that make up Saskatchewan, you know, there's over 100,000 First Nations people, Indigenous peoples. Now, the terminology now piece, okay? Just so you know, just so you have a background. Like, to answer that, what do we call them? You know? And it goes back so long, and there's so many debates and dialogue. You know, so in some cases, you know, Indians, we're not going to get into debate whether that's acceptable or not, you know, but it's around and it's a legal term, you know. So when we talk about the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations, that's been around for 65 years. I've been toying with the idea to change the name to the Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations. Probably make more sense, you know, at some point. That's a work in progress. It's a work in progress. So when we look at the different terminology now, just so I'm going to make these comments on these and I'll lead it into resource revenue share. Because when I read the newspaper and I see Native man, got picked up for whatever. And I think, well, was that guy an Indian or a Métis guy? You know? What was it? You know, so like, so you have this word Indian. In some places it's acceptable. In some places it isn't acceptable. You know? So that's one word, Indian. Then you have native. It's another word, right? Natives. The natives are restless. Idle no more. So natives is another one, right? And then you got Aboriginal, you know, which refers to Indians, Métis, and Inuit, and that's in Canada's Constitution, right? You know, and then you've got on-reserve Indians, off-reserve Indians, status Indians, non-status Indians, you know, and then you have Indigenous peoples, you know, and then you have in Saskatchewan. If you're and First Nations is the other one, which sounds good too, eh? We're First Nations. We're first. You know? So what term? What is it? And the simplest answer, if you don't know, ask. What are you comfortable with? You know? Personally, and this is my own viewpoint, I don't like native because it's mixing bowl. Because even in Canada's Constitution, it refers to Indians, Métis, and Inuit. So you got to always watch the mixing bowl because you don't want to disrespect the Métis people as well. You know, because they're distinct. They have their own history, their own language as well. Just go to Batoche, you know. So there's a unique history there that has to be respected. You know, so be wary of the mixing bowl, right? You know, that's the same. So when you say, oh, you're Aboriginal, you know, again, a bit of a mixing bowl, right? Native, bit of a mixing bowl, you know. First Nations, then you start talking about, because in Canada, out of those 633 reserves, 633 chiefs, depending who you talk to, but there's over 58 different nations, if you will. What I mean by that is languages. 58 indigenous languages. So from the East Coast, you got the Mi'kmaq, Pasquamani, Maliseet. You have the Ojibwe, the Anishinaabek, the peoples, right? The Mohawk, the Ongahoa. That's how they say that. I like that. The Ongahoa, you know, Kanawagi, Kanasatagi. You know, I like how that language flows. And so right across Canada, right? And so there's over 58. So language, First Nations, what is it? So in Saskatchewan, all you have here in Saskatchewan, you have the Dene Santlene. I see some Dene people here. The Dene Santlene people, you know, out of those 74 reserves now in Saskatchewan, you have Dene people. Dene Santlene people, you have Ojibwe people, Anishinaabek people, Nakoda people, Soto peoples, all the same thing, right? You also have the Nehiyawak peoples, Cree people, Swampy Cree, Plains Cree, Woodland Cree. You also have the Dakota, Lakota, Nakoda tribes, okay? That's what you have. So out of those 74 reserves, if you ask, where are you from? You will know what nation they belong to. Okay? Because most of those reserves will identify as being one of those 7 in Saskatchewan or one of those 58 across Canada. But in this province now, Saskatchewan, that's what you have. Okay? So the terminology to my friends, relatives, it varies. Some are comfortable with the word Indian. Some don't like it. Some thinks it's passé. But it's still a debate. And it's still in Canada's Constitution. Right? We still have the Indian Act, you know. So we have all these terms. So some places, yeah, I'm a Treaty Indian, I'm from Little Black Bear, and I'm Cree, you know. Some of our chiefs, we have debates as well, you know. Don't refer to us as Indians. It's passé. Get up with the 2014s now, you know. You know, it's passé and guaranteed. You go to a national chiefs meeting, someone will use the word, and then another chief will get up and say, hey, you're using the wrong word, you know, and they'll say this, they'll say, Christopher Columbus thought he landed on India, so he referred to us and called us Indians. What if he would have landed on Turkey? He would have called us Turkeys. It's a stale joke. I've heard it 50 million times. Indigenous peoples, you know, I think that's really catching on now, you know, so between Indians, First Nations, Indigenous peoples, so there's a bit of a progression, okay, and as Indigenous peoples, we're Cree, or Dakota, Lakota, Dene. And that's how it is. Okay? So you got to take your pick as you go through. So that's a little bit on the governance piece. Okay? from the reserve, little black bear, to all these things we belong to, which can change. But the constants that will never change are little black bear over here this way to treaty. That will never change. And hopefully belonging to the Cree Nation will never change. So those are the constants, what we have to work with here as Indigenous peoples. So now that kind of sets the tone a little bit. So you have a little bit of background. So I was asked to come on and talk about resource revenue sharing. What does that mean? What does that look like? Why do we even bring it up? So I want to demonstrate, to the class today, the relevancy and the importance of this issue. It's not only a local, regional issue. It's a national issue. It's an international issue in terms of recognition of rights and title, in terms of recognition of and closing the huge socio-economic gap that exists between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples in this country. So it's a huge issue, and it's timely. And I want to hopefully shape your minds and give you something to think about and make you go, good point. Or that could be debated, or something. And that's what it's all about. So now we set that constant. And I put Saskatchewan First Nations in the province's resource future, the path to economic certainty. Sounds really cool. So what I've done is just, this is what's in this package. I wanted to show a map of the minerals in Saskatchewan first thing. From uranium in the north, to coal in the south, to oil, coal, gas, to potash, to diamonds, to timber, you name it. Saskatchewan is a real economic powerhouse. And Saskatchewan's economy is booming because of the natural resource wealth. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that. Some of the major events, and this is, it's not a constitutional law class. But I want to get into some of the things that make up this nation's constitution and why we say there are lawful legal obligations when it comes to looking at that whole issue of resource revenue sharing. So I want to hopefully make a case where you guys get it and see it and say, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's unfinished treaty business. That's what I want the lights to go off in the next 2 hours, our lights to go on. That makes sense. So, anyway, this is just a summary, but I want to get right into it now, okay? So, you probably can't see all of this, but this is just a general map that people can get, From the north is uranium. I'm just going to make the general points. In the north, there's a lot of uranium. Cameco, there's people from Cameco here. There used to be, Areva. Big companies, right, in the north, uranium. Board of directors here. You can put your hand up, Ron, Don, come on. So Cameco, and I hold up those companies for sure because recently they had two of my colleagues and friends as vice presidents, of corporate social responsibility, CSR, Gary Morassi and Richard Gladue. Richard Gladue worked at Areva as a VP. Gary Morassi worked as a VP at Cameco. Great. That's fantastic. Trying to influence policy and programming from inside that corporate boardroom and corporate table. That's fantastic. I've always said we got to see more First Nations people at all levels of decision making. More First Nations people on the boards and in those boardrooms. More First Nations people as CEOs. More First Nations people on the cabinet table. More First Nations people in the Senate where all those decisions are made. We got to see all of that. So I really hold up people. More First Nations people as presidents of U of S. We that can happen. So that's a good thing. And I hold up those two companies for getting people involved in that system. But that's uranium, right? Southern part of Saskatchewan, you got potash developments. You've heard of all the potash in the south. You had Agrium, you had PCS, you've had Mosaic. Three companies have been operating for 30, 40 years in potash mining. Now you have K plus S, the new mine by Bethune. You got BHP, the new mine by Jensen. So two new big international companies kind of coming in. And I lift up BHP, and I make no bones about it. Why? They raised the bar. They raised the bar in terms of how to partner with, First Nations people, how to develop relationships with First Nations people. And because I'm going to say it in a respectful way, not a lot was happening with the existing three potash companies. Not a lot. But when K plus S comes in, BHP comes in, a little competition is good. You know? So anyway, there's companies operating in the province, right? All throughout, so Saskatchewan is huge. Huge natural resource wealth. Very important. Very important. That's all I wanted to point out with this slide. Lots of resources in Saskatchewan. That's why the economy is booming. And I've always made this point. And it's fantastic that the economy is booming. It would boom even louder if the Indigenous peoples were part of that boom. And there was no more economic marginalization. You know, and there was, people will get their heads around embracing concepts of self-determination, concept of Aboriginal rights and title, concepts of treaty implementation, because it's good for everybody. You know? So the boom will get even louder. Of those 100,000 First Nations people in Saskatchewan, of those 633 First Nations across Canada, one of the points I always make is this. Unfortunately, we're not all living in the same healthy, great conditions, you know? And I always use this 6 versus 63rd. In terms of the human development level of, in the, what's the right word? The human development index, you know, within the United Nations. And within the United Nations system, when Canada was rated, it was rated 6th in terms of quality of life in the world. You know, good housing, good education, you know, kids are healthy and everything else, you know. But you apply those same indices to Indigenous peoples. We go from 6th to 63rd. 63rd. So their issue is basically third world conditions. The issue is poverty. And so I always say this in a respectful way. If people cannot get their heads around the rights issue, if they can't get their heads around self-government, self-determination, then at least get your head around the business case. There's a high social cost to poverty. There's a high cost to that poverty. And so how do you make strategic investments now to change that around, to close that socioeconomic gap that exists in this country from 63rd to being 6th? So that's the issue. That's one of the big issues. And one of the ways we see of closing that socioeconomic gap is embracing the concept called resource revenue sharing. Whether you call it resource benefit sharing, economic certainty, I don't care what you call it, but it's going to help closing that socioeconomic gap, and that's good for everybody. That high social cost of poverty will be lessened and lowered. Now, events leading up, and this is going to be the history, and this is, I wanted to go right to this one. This is basically what I'm going to cover here. And why there's a legitimacy to our claim. Some of the things that are really starting to be called into question now, not only in Canada, but the world, is the first one is the doctrine of discovery. Do you guys know what that is? Yes? No? No? The doctrine of discovery is when a country would come to another foreign land and plant a flag and claim it for that country that plants the flag. The first one's there. Right? So the doctrine of discovery within the United Nations structure and the Holy See has called upon and stated that that doctrine is a racist doctrine. So I start from there. So how could you come to a country called Canada or USA or wherever and plant a flag and call it for that country? We just made a trip to England a few months back to mark the Royal Proclamation 250th year anniversary. I was going to bring a Treaty 4 flag and plant it right in front of London, right in front of the Buckingham Palace. It's now claimed for Treaty 4. So the doctrine of discovery, again, is starting to be challenged as not being a legitimate doctrine to base anything on terms of how a country or nation states has claimed land and territory. Terra Nullius. Vacant land, land belonging to no people, the Mabo decision, very important case, you know. So I asked early on, how many are, you guys are in master's program for public policy, right? But this is important, because what I'm trying to demonstrate is, there's a starting growing trend of legal analysis, of thought that are changing in the world. And the Mabo decision, again, Aborigines in Australia, right? The indigenous peoples, you know, of the world. And I know I'm jumping ahead, but when the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples was passed a few years ago, there were only 5 countries that did not support that declaration. Can anybody guess which 5 they were? USA, you know, New Zealand, you know, Australia, Canada, you know, was right in there. Where's the other one? There were only 4, sorry, 4, not 5. Strike that from the record. Only 4 countries. And isn't it ironic that those 4 nation states have huge population of indigenous peoples, right? The Maori people in New Zealand didn't support it. The Aborigines in Australia, Australia didn't support it. Same thing with the USA and Canada. They have since changed their minds. But initially, those 4 nation states didn't support it. So that's what we challenge right away. Terra Nullius, the doctrine. It's something that people were living there. Indigenous peoples were there. And so those things are important. So I start with those concepts. This Royal Proclamation of 1763, why that's important? It forms part of Canada's constitution. The Royal Proclamation of 1763, King George III said, hey, we hold it up as Indians, First Nations people, because it recognized First Nations title to land and territory. And that's the first time ever. The Crown, not us, but the Crown recognized our title as Indigenous peoples. That's important. So a few months back, on October 7th, the 250-year anniversary of the Royal Proclamation of 1763, we took the opportunity to mark that occasion. Only because our link and our relationship is with the Crown as Indigenous peoples. Okay? So it was important to keep that recognition with the Crown intact. And some will say that, why are we marking the Royal Proclamation? That was the start of colonization and domination, you know, on Turtle Island. Why are we holding that whole doctrine up, you know, the Royal Proclamation? There's one school of thought that says that. Our school of thought was, hey, a foreign crown recognized our title to land and territory. Don't you think we should be marking that and recognizing that? Of course. Of course. So which is why we sent a delegation to England. Which is why we kept that relationship with the crown intact because of the Royal Proclamation. The 1867 BNA Act. Now I'm just going to skim these because I'm going to go through more materials, more details. Why is that important? Canada's Constitution. We're a colony of Great Britain. We're a colony of Great Britain. That's important because of Section 9124. Federal fiduciary trust obligations. The feds are responsible for Indians. It says the feds are federal government is responsible for Indians and Indian lands. That's what it says. It doesn't say Indians on Indian lands. It says Indians and Indian lands. Further recognition of title to lands and territory. Very important piece. Federal fiduciary trust responsibility. It wasn't the province's responsibility. It was the federal government's responsibility. 1870 Imperial Order and Council. Another important piece of legislation, if you will. And what is the 1870 Order and Council? That forms part of Canada's constitution. It basically states this, because remember, ever wonder how Alaska became part of the United States? You got to know that history. Really interesting history. But Alaska, Alaska's part of USA. Go visit Sarah. She's up there. Exercising her right to hunt moose. She's a hunter. Anyway, she's up there. But Alaska's part of USA. So when you go back through history and you see that what's happening back in the 1860s, 1870s, you know, and Rupert's Land and Northwest Territories here in Canada, you know, there's a fear that Canada would be sucked up by the states again, right? that's what happened. It started in Alaska. Hey, that could happen to everything else here in terms of Rupert's Land, in terms of the Northwest Territories. And so Canada wrote to the British Crown Parliament saying, hey, assure us that these lands will be kept in Canada. Okay? So in simple layman terms, the 1870 Imperial Order and Council says that, okay? It says this, and we're going to go into more detail. We'll keep the land in Canada, but when lands are taken up for settlement, there's a principle of equitable compensation that should be put in place for the Aborigines. You know, that's important. Very important piece. When lands are taken up for settlement, that those principles of fair, equitable compensation should be put in place. Very important piece. We're going to come back to that. 1874, in Saskatchewan, you have Treaty 4, Treaty 5, Treaty 6, Treaty 8, Treaty 10, the number of treaties, the Victorian treaties. And in Treaty 4's terms, you know, our people will say, and we're going to spend a little bit more time on this, when Little Black Bear entered into treaty, I never say our chief signed treaty. I always tell Indigenous peoples, First Nations people, Indians, don't say our chief signed treaties. They couldn't read or write English or French. How could they sign something? You know? But they exercised that inherent right and entered into a treaty with the Crown. They entered into a treaty with the Crown. And so our understanding, and we can spend a little bit of time on that treaty understanding, but in exchange for sharing territory, in Treaty 4, it's 75,000 square miles of territory. In Treaty 6, it's 125,000 square miles of territory. Each of the number of treaties has a very specific geographic area described. So in exchange for sharing that territory, certain rights were promised to our people. You know, the Medicine Chest Clause in Treaty 6, treaty right to health. The Education Clause in Treaty 4, settling on the reserves, Little River Schoolhouse, spirit intent to education. You know, hunting, fishing, trapping, and gathering, our avocations will continue. Treaty rights were promised. They were inherent rights, but confirmed through treaties, treaty rights. Sharing the land. And why this is important here, why I put depth of a plow. Our old people do this, and I always do this. I'm becoming famous for doing this, my two thumbs up speech. That means, our old people said, this is what we'll share with our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters. We can't give you Mother Earth. We can't give it to you, but we'll share. So sharing. And that whole principle of peaceful coexistence and mutual respect between our peoples is very fundamental to that treaty-making process. How it was consecrated as a covenant, you know, through the pipe ceremony, through all those ceremonies we hold so sacred. It's like a covenant with the Creator and our people. So I didn't bring my treaty medallion. But it has the sun on it, the water, the grass, shaking of hands, the hatchet being buried. Right? Then on the other back of it, you have Queen Victoria. Treaty medallions were given to our chiefs. Very important connection relationship with the sovereign. Depth of a plow. And I've been at this for 30-some years. Where did I get this teaching from? Where did I get that from? Who told me that? It was two old elders. I used to go visit all the time. They would scold me. They would give me in a respectful way, though. Because they thought, oh, I was at the tribal council at TFHQ at the time. I was a tribal chief, you know. And I was supposedly working on promoting and protecting treaties and treaty rights. So I was visiting old late Deaf Henry Kay from Kuankatoos and old Mote, Joe Whitehead. I'd always go visit them. They're spiritual elders, spiritual people. And they'd say, oh, no, some. What are you doing? That big government had no right to give to this little government. Kaki, all this resource, this much is what we share. This much. What are you doing to fix that? What are you doing? You know? So I grew up listening to these old people. These teachings about depth of a plow. And it was so consistent, so consistent from Treaty 4 to Treaty 6 to Alberta Treaty 7, because they've been over there as well. You know, and it's so consistent. The elders' oral history and understanding of treaty. Who might argue with that? The elders' oral history is so important. Cling to that and believe it. It's the simplest way. So that's important. Treaty 4, depth of a plow. Indian Act, 1876. We still have it to this day. Why I put that in there is because there was one clause in the Indian Act that basically stated, you Indians can't have access to legal counsel. You know, and we're going to show you that clause in the Indian Act that was there until 1951. You know, so I put that in there just to show you what we've had to deal with, you know, in trying to bring this forward. You know, so that was 1876. And as well, 1905, Saskatchewan was formed. Saskatchewan becomes part of Confederation, along with Alberta, you know. So when you have that federal government with that federal fiduciary trust obligation to Indian people through Section 9124, then all of a sudden, and then in the treaties that came before the provinces, right? That came before. So who has jurisdiction? Who was there first? That whole thing comes into mind. But by Saskatchewan being formed, you know, there's another jurisdiction that was established, okay, in 1905. Then in 1930, the 1930 Natural Resources Transfer Agreement, a federal piece of legislation that was enacted because Manitoba government, Saskatchewan government, and the Alberta government were complaining to the federal government that we're not the same as Ontario and Nova Scotia and all those new provinces out east. They control all their natural resource wealth. We want to be the same. So when you research the NRTA, go into Hansard, go into all the debates and the dialogue in the House of Commons from 1922 right up until 1929 to 1930 when it was enacted. You'll see the whole dialogue. You'll see the whole debates, all the arguments, why this is has to happen because we're not treated the same. So in 1930, the feds passed this piece of legislation called the 1930 Natural Resources Transfer Agreement, and they transferred everything to the provincial government's control. So all, remember the first slide? All the uranium, all the coal, all that became from the feds now over to provincial jurisdiction. Where were the Indian people? We were indigenous peoples. Well, we were stuck on the reserve. We couldn't leave without a permit. You got to get a permit from the Indian agent, so we couldn't really get organized. Oh, and we didn't have access to legal counsel till 1951, so that was a problem. You know, so were we consulted? No. So depth of a plow. Did anybody have a chance to convey the depth of a plow understanding to the prime minister and cabinet of the day in 1929-28? No. But it was done. So I've always referred to it as unfinished treaty business. We're not done yet. We haven't concluded our negotiations yet. And it's 2014. So anyway, NRTA. Then in 1982, Canada's Patriation of the Constitution. Very big day. Remember that 1982? It was raining. Even a big raindrop went on the Constitution in 1982. Because there was a big debate between treaty Indians. Is this good for us or bad for us? You know? And there's a whole group of treaty Indians that were trying to stop the Constitution from coming back to Canada because it will break the link with the British sovereign, break the link with the British crown, and will somehow in some way impede First Nations jurisdiction. It will somehow impede First Nations sovereignty. Because now we've become part of the domestic state called Canada. But anyway, it happened in 1982. Section 35. Existing Aboriginal and treaty rights are recognized and affirmed. Existing Aboriginal and treaty rights are recognized and affirmed. Section 35. Full box of rights, empty box. It's in Canada's constitution, supreme law of this land. It's a constitution. It's 2014. We still have the debate. Is it a full box of rights? Or an empty box of rights. Still have a debate to this day. Then I throw in some other things in there. Supreme Court rulings, Supreme Court of Canada rulings. Dalgamuk, very important piece. Dalgamuk, Aboriginal title exists. Elders' oral history is admissible as evidence. Very important, 1997. Haida and Taku Supreme Court decisions in Haida. Aboriginal rights and title are recognized. Duty to consult and accommodate. That's where everybody across Canada, everybody's talking about. Dude, we have a duty to consult and accommodate. Where did that come from? It came from these two chiefs, these two First Nations standing up and fighting all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And I always ask other chiefs across Canada in this province, where were you? Did you help them politically or legally or financially? No. But we're all benefiting because everybody's saying, duty, consult, and accommodate. Duty, consult, and accommodate. That's a big issue. What does that mean? Duty to consult and accommodate. Industry. You have an obligation for consultation and accommodation. Governments. You have an obligation for consultation and accommodation. You can't just go take the resource wealth without Indigenous people's rights being acknowledged and respected. That's what that said. Mikisew Cree, Taku River. Very important. Then, UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, 2007. Everybody's on side with this now. Why is that important? We see it's important because it's more than an aspirational document. You know, it's a document that's a bare minimum in terms of recognition of inherent rights, treaty rights, fundamental human rights internationally. And within the UN Declaration, there's a certain section that will speak to free, prior, and informed consent before any lands, any resources, any water is taken. Free, prior, and informed consent from Indigenous peoples. For me, that's better than Taku River and Mikisew Cree. To me, that's better than duty, consult, and accommodate. So that's why I put it here. Free, prior, and informed consent. Recognition of Indigenous peoples' right to self-determination is very important. Along with that right to self-determination as Indigenous peoples means the ability to say yes to a development or no to a development. And that's a key thing to keep in mind. If the inherent right to self-determination is recognized by nation states' governments, federal provincial governments, and our industry, the right to say yes or no. Look at the prosperity mine in BC, last couple of weeks. Prosperity mine in BC, the First Nations in that territory, the Chilcotin peoples, have said no to prosperity once, twice, third time. Now the Environmental Review Agency agreed with them that that development cannot go ahead because of the impact on that lake, on the streams and the rivers. It can't go ahead because it would kill that environment. That's the inherent right to self-determination being respected. And when you go to the Chilcotin people, and I've been there, I know Chief Roger William, Chief Joe Alphonse. They're not opposed to development, but they want to be involved in managing it so it's done in a sustainable way so the environment is not hurt in a negative way. So instead of a development like this, they would support something maybe smaller, you know, something smaller, more manageable, you know. That's their position. And I think it's a great position because it's sustainable economic development. And the recognition that the economy is a 100% owned subsidiary of the environment. Business students may not get that, but think of it in that term. That the economy is 100% owned subsidiary of the environment. Finding the balance. Finding the balance. So there, from the UN Declaration, 2013 UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And I put that there because we hosted him. We had him in Saskatchewan. I am having a brain lapse here. In terms of the name, Val.
James
Anaya. Professor James Anaya. We hosted him here. And he went out throughout the different territories of Saskatchewan, the north, down, south, Treaty 4. And he's the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And he came out with a preliminary report in Canada. And he found that in such a rich country like Canada, that it's appalling and sad that there's still much poverty amongst Indigenous peoples. That was one of his findings. I'm just ad-libbing in terms of his findings. He mentioned the overcrowded housing conditions. He mentioned the high suicides amongst our youth. And his bottom line was that it is so, our relationship with this nation state government is so unnecessarily confrontational. Unnecessarily confrontational. That's what's hindering developments. That's what's hindering the recognition of Aboriginal rights and title, inherent rights, treaty rights, self-determination. And it doesn't have to be that way. That was in his finding, in his report. And he also supported things like extensions to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you know, made a recommendation to do that. Also pushed for a whole national public inquiry to missing and murdered Aboriginal women. You know, they were part of that report. You know, and his final report's coming out in September. It'll be heard in New York, September of this year, 2014. Why I put that in there? It's unnecessarily adversarial. And I even made a point. Concerns raised over Indian Affairs, $106 million on litigation, is the highest in Canada. $106 million on lawyers to fight inherent rights and title and treaty rights. I thought, wow, that doesn't sound right. It doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be that way. And then I talk about that on the bottom there. So now, that's your outline. Are you ready for all the rest of the 25 slides? This is just trying to show you that there is a case to be made. No question. How do we resolve the issue? How do we resolve the issue? And I'm going to try to move along, but this gives you the framework. This is what it is. It's like the history. Like, so when I say and I debate with people, these aren't just something we're pulling out of thin air. It isn't. There's a whole history here, constitutional obligations, legal, lawful obligations that must be respected, because a lot of these things are already part of Canada's constitution. We just want them to be respected and followed. That's all we want. And if we're going to breed and foster economic certainty in this province and in this country, yes, there's got to be a national energy strategy involving First Nations people and involving industry and governments. And it's value added because it's balancing the economy, but as well balancing the respect for the land and water and the territories, the environment. That's value added, totally value added. So what are we leaving for our children, grandchildren, and seven generations down the road? We don't want to leave them a big headache. So sustainable economic development is key. So now, the Order in Council, you know, and that's my line there when it says that upon the transference of the territories in question to the Canadian government, it will be our duty to make adequate provision for the protection of the Indian tribes whose interests and well-being are involved in the transfer. They're going to look after us. But the first one up there, that upon the transference of the territories in question to the Canadian government, the claims of the Indian tribes to compensation for lands required for purposes of settlement will be considered and settled in conformity with the equitable principles which have uniformly governed the British Crown and its dealings with the Aborigines. That's in the Order in Council, 1870 Royal Order in Council. So I always look to my fellow Aborigines. No, I didn't put that in the what should we call them term. But fellow Indigenous peoples, have you ever been compensated? Has anybody come and said, hey, this is for all the land and territory that we're sharing? Have you ever been compensated? Has never been, but it's part of Canada's Constitution. That's the 1870 Order in Council. That's what that is. Okay? Now, this is just a little bit of the history about why they even came up with that. And the third bullet, the United States acquires Alaska in 1867. Our fear, the Canadian fears are heightened that the U.S. will acquire the Northwest Territories, which is what it was at the time. So they write to British Parliament saying, hey, give us some assurance here that we're not going to be sucked up. You know, we'll all be under Obamacare. You know, like that didn't happen because of all these things, standing up for that 49th parallel line, standing up for jurisdiction. Okay, that's that. So why again? And this is public, so I'm sure all the Supreme Court judges are watching this, and I'm sure my good friend Mitch McAdam is watching this. He's the lawyer for the province of Saskatchewan. And so I'm outlining my legal challenge here. So I'm sure they'll be preparing. And that's fine, you know. But we're looking at it as a way to get our heads in dialogue around the table that these are lawful obligations. Rather than go all the way to the Supreme Court and waste everybody's time, energy, and money, let's set up a process so we can work through this thing. That's basically what we want. That's what we're after. But if we have to go legally, I think we've got a pretty strong argument. So, but we want to, let's get to the table and resolve it. So anyway, that's what the order in council is, right? And the scope of the constitutional duty is there. So that's that order in council. Treaty 4. Now again, treaties are really, I could spend a whole week on treaty. You know, I could spend just getting it. Because we're all treaty people. You've heard that line time and time again. So in exchange for sharing land, our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters have the usufructuary right to the land, the right to use it. It's almost like it's disheartening sometimes because even in Cree, it's Skunagin reserves. Like it's almost like some have interpreted it as leftover land. You know? That's what our reservations, sometimes people look upon as all the best land's gone, and we're given these little patches of land. You know, it's Skunagin. Land's left aside, land's set aside, leftover land almost. But it's sovereign land. That's how I view it. And even in Treaty 4, old gambler, he raised the cane, raised some cane. These, when we say Soto First Nations, refused to enter into negotiation with the Treaty Commission because Alexander Morris was a Treaty Commissioner. Alexander Morris was the guy that came out and negotiated these treaties with our chiefs. He met Little Black Bear. Alexander Morris met Little Black Bear. He met Kowakatus. He met Wapimustosis. He met Daystar. He met all of these chiefs, all the names of these reserves. He was the guy. So when you ever wonder how our reserves got their names? About 90% of the time, it's because it takes on the name of the chief that really entered into treaty with the crown. Right? So Alexander Morris was the queen's representative. Because John A. Macdonald knew the crown didn't have title to the land. So we can't just open it up for settlement. We've got to find a mechanism. So the mechanism that they chose was treaty making. So the Queen's commissioner, Alexander Morris, was sent out west. And these were some, if you really want to understand treaty, you need three things. Get a copy of Alexander Morris's treaty book. Because after he concluded all the discussions, negotiations with the treaty chiefs, he made a book. So get that book, Alexander Morris's treaty book, Treaties of the Indians in the Northwest Territories, right? He put his memoirs in there. He captured all the verbal and oral dialogue and discussions. That's one piece. You also need the treaty itself. It's amazing that some of our own chiefs, one time I was in a treaty meeting, I was, chief, have you even seen the treaty? Some of our own leadership have not even seen the original treaty or a copy of the treaty. You know, but we talk treaty all the time. So that's important. Get a copy of the treaty. Read it. But the most important thing is the elders' oral history and how they understand it. So talking to old people, talking to the elders, our experts on treaty. Those three things you need. The Alexander Morris treaty book, the treaty itself, and lots of cups of tea and bannock and lard talking to our old people. To get that understanding about the spirit and intent of treaty. What was actually understood. Because remember, they didn't understand English or French. They spoke Cree, they spoke Soto, they spoke Assiniboine. That's their languages. So, do you think Little Black Bear and Mr. Wasses, the chiefs, understood this legal term, cede, surrender, and relinquish? Do you think that was explained properly? No es esto, thing. I don't understand. You know, but sharing, peace, working together, we're all to benefit from the land. Concepts that could be caught on pretty quick. So, in Treaty 4, this is just Treaty 4, right? So, lawyers, on behalf of the Department of Justice, federal and provincial departments of justice, will hold up the treaty and say, look what it says here, Chief Bellegarde. This was agreed to. Well, whose interpretation, whose understanding? You know, let's be clear on that. How was that interpretation understood? You know? So, Treaty 4 in itself, right? And this is where it said, they've consistently said, our forefathers agreed to share the land to the depth of a plow. That is so consistent. And I've been all over Canada. In the last 30 years, having cups of tea. And it's consistent wherever. And so these people aren't coached. These people aren't, oh, this is what you got to say. This is what you got to do. It just comes so naturally. It comes and flows so naturally. So that's an important piece to me. So that's why in treaty, you got to have those three things. But again, it's depth of a plow. Sharing the depth of a plow. The rest is unfinished treaty business. Now, I put this up here. Because across Canada, what's happening regarding resource revenue sharing agreements? Is there anything out there we can look at modeling? Is there anything out there, best practices? What's going on? BC, they're trying to talk about in their modern BC treaty process. You know, they've been at it 20-some years. There's only been two concluded. Right? So it's really problematic because governments will look at extinguishment of Aboriginal rights and title first before we move on. That's the problem. You got to extinguish your Aboriginal right and title before we can even look at a modern treaty agreement. You know, that's problematic. It doesn't have to be that way. But they have something going on in BC, the Nisga Treaty. It contains clauses in the Nisga Treaty in 2000 about resource revenue sharing in a very specific geographic area. Okay? About jurisdiction. Title and rights to a very specific geographic area. So that's happening through the Nisga Agreement. Again, we talked about Haida and Taku, recent Supreme Court decisions. Why I put them in there again? So the whole goal of treaty making is to reconcile Aboriginal rights with other rights and interests. It's not a process to replace our extinguished rights. Reconciliation is not a final legal remedy in the usual sense. Expected outcomes are just settlements and honorable agreements. Quoting Supreme Court judges. They're very important Supreme Court decisions. Mikisew Cree, I put Haida and Taku River because they're BC cases, right? From BC, where Aboriginal rights and title are big. That's their arguments. I put in Mikisew Cree because that's in Treaty 6, Treaty 8 territory. So it still applies to the treaty territories. And then this one, just recently, NWT, big time. Big time news. Northwest Territories Intergovernmental Resource Revenue Sharing Agreement signed February 27. This is fresh. It's brand new. It's happening over there. Kudos to the leaders. You know, five Aboriginal governments sets out terms and conditions for sharing resource revenues from MWT public lands, guaranteeing Aboriginal governments will get up to 25% of all royalty revenue. Unprecedented sharing arrangement in Canada. Woohoo! It's happening. People are starting to get it. So this is just something to show you as public policy makers. The tide is slowly changing. Things are slowly changing. And how do we embrace that change? And to the industry leaders, to industry, you know, and I meet with Premier Wall and Cabinet and everybody. I've met with Premier Calvert, everybody. This issue is not going away. It's how do we resolve it? You know, to a simple thing like even starting with things like Before provincial governments issue licenses and permits to industry to go take the natural resources, before that happens, why don't you have a policy in place whereby that company and that CEO have to show you as provincial governments that they have a plan in place to engage First Nations Métis people? You know, a representative workforce strategy, a procurement strategy. Why can't that happen? Why do you think Cameco is doing so good? That was a requirement years ago. The provincial government said, Cameco, you can't just go take it. You show me how you're going to engage that local workforce. And you put it in part of your plans. Problem is, it never happened for the other potash industries. It never happened for any other potash mines. It just happened for Cameco. So why can't that change? So all you future deputy ministers, fix that. Make it a simple policy change. Because that's all it takes. You don't have to make a law, but before you issue a license or permit, you know, and I'm just being brainstorming here as simple things. It doesn't deal with jurisdiction, doesn't deal with sovereignty, doesn't deal with the depth of a plow, but it deals with something that's very practical as first steps for getting people involved in the economy in a very meaningful, substantive way. That could happen. That's just one little thing. The Indian Act, and this is in 1927, and this was in place till 1951. You know, this was the wording in the Indian Act. There's no way you could have access to a lawyer, you know. You couldn't even get access to legal counsel to substantiate any Aboriginal claim. It was illegal. It was illegal. And I put this in here to show you what we've had to work with. All the challenges, all the hurdles, the obstacles. You know, trying to stand up for our rights and title. You couldn't. Think of it when you couldn't even leave the reserve without a permit. You know, that was part of the Indian Act. You know, couldn't even go anywhere. So how could you get organized? How could you start standing up for your rights? In terms of the economy, you couldn't even sell your own cattle or your own wheat without a permit from the Indian agent. You know, so that's the Indian Act. I just show you that to show that's just a small piece, you know, of the control and the domination of what is basically what's happened. I always say, you know, if I had to characterize the nation state called Canada in terms of how it basically dealt with public policy towards Indigenous peoples, is like civilize the Indigenous peoples first. That's one word. Civilize them. They're pagan people. They don't know nothing about God or the Creator. You know, they're not like us as Christians, so civilize them. Then it was assimilate them. Make them like us. Make them conform. Make them give up their Indian identity. You know, make them become enfranchised and join the old good old social boys club so they can own land and go to university and become pastors. You know, assimilate them. And if you got an education, you're no longer Indian. You know, then it was terminate. Terminate the Indian status. Terminate the Indian people. Terminate their special status. You know, they've done that through the residential schools. You know, you can see that. Cultural genocide was termination. Anything good about being Indian is no good. Your language is no good. Your ceremonies are no good. Your customs are no good. Break up your family home. You know, nothing is good about being Indians. It's a termination policy, cultural genocide policy. You know, and then now it's integration. So those words, those four words can capture 500 years of how we've dealt with governments. Civilize, assimilate, terminate, integrate. And then to our Indigenous people, our young men and women that are getting good educations, you know, integrate into society. You got to feel good about who you are, right? And then through the residential school system, you've all heard about the abuses, physical, mental, physical, all of that. Just brutal. Just imagine your 5 or 6 year old kid, your son, daughter, niece, nephew, being taken away and subjugated to that type of treatment for 11 years. Oh, and then as well, we just found out they did experiments on those little poor Indian children, depriving them of vitamins, depriving them of food, and doing test studies. Brutal. In Canada. Great place to live. You know, learn from the past, don't dwell there. We got to move forward, no question. But this is the harsh reality. And so Integration now to our young men and women? Definitely, you need a good education. But equally as important is not to ever forget your languages, customs, traditions, ceremonies. So you're proud of who you are as a Cree, as a Dene, as a Dakota, and that it's good, you know. And you see that happening, starting to rise up now. It's stronger. You see more people attending ceremonies. Never used to be like that. It was taboo. Not good. Now, NRTA. How much time do I have here? I was supposed to take a break, eh?
I think we wrap her up around 3.
Okay, I'm going to go fast. NRTA. Okay? This is important. Subject to any existing trust. So a clause in the NRTA, I think it's section 10. In order that the province may be in the same position as the original provinces of Confederation. Remember my earlier point about Nova Scotia and everybody else had everything? Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta didn't have it, so they were complaining. The interests of the Crown and all Crown lands, mines, minerals, precious and base, and royalties derived therefrom within the province shall belong to the province subject to any existing trusts. Remember I said federal fiduciary trust obligation? Section 9124? Subject to existing trusts, this 1930 NRTA was passed. I'm saying, I've always pointed out, there were existing trusts. Federal government, you buggered up. How do we deal with it now? How do we fix it? How do we remedy it? Horseman, Justice Corey. Check that case out. Very important. And this is what he's saying, Supreme Court decision. Justice Corey questioned the power of the federal government to enact the NRTA in Horseman. And this is his words. Although it might well be politically and morally unacceptable in today's climate to take such a step as that settled in the 1930 agreement without consultation, you know, by Indians, anyway, without consultation with and concurrence of the native people affected, nonetheless, the power of the federal government to unilaterally make such a modification is unquestioned and has not been challenged in this case. Window. Has anybody tried to jump through that window? Not yet, but pretty damn soon. Because that has not been challenged or questioned in the case. Again, lawful obligation, opportunity. But we don't want to do that. Let's come to the table to resolve this. So there's economic certainty in Saskatchewan. So there's ripe for investment for all industry to come in. But make sure First Nations people are part of it. So this is very, very clear things, you know. So questions, I'm just going to wrap up now. Questions, you know. The 1870 set a standard, you know. The Imperial Order Council established treaty commissions. Were those instructions to Alexander Morris consistent with the Royal Proclamation and the 1870 Imperial Order? You know. Can Treaty 4 be interpreted consistent with First Nations understanding they were sharing only the depth of a plow? Okay. Treaty 4, First Nations and all First Nations were to be compensated pursuant to the 1870 Order and Council. These are questions, right? So if the Surrender Clause had effect of extinguishing First Nations claims within meaning of the 1870 Imperial Order, did Canada meet its constitutional duty to make adequate provision for protection of Indian tribes whose interests and well-being are involved in the transfer? You know? And if not, did it breach its constitutional obligation? Questions, when you get to the Supreme Court, you're going to have to answer. So, other questions. NRTA. Federal government, did it breach its fiduciary obligation? Did it affect our rights? And I use Treaty 4, but you can use these same principles for Treaty 6, Treaty 7, Treaty 8, Treaty 9. I only use Treaty 4 because that's where I'm from. You know, and I know that. And I know the elders teach it, but they're consistent. Okay? Again, just questions. Being compensated. All those things. So for me, and this is, I'm wrapping up for questions now too. I wanted to demonstrate the past, present, you know, in terms of there is really a lot of legalities to it. You know. So when next time when you see Chief Bellegarde get up, and maybe debate Premier Wall on these things and say these are more than just political promises. that there will be no special revenue sharing group for any group in Saskatchewan. I said, well, we're not any special group. We're Indigenous peoples with the inherent right to self-determination. And we're to mutually benefit and share from the lands and resource wealth and territories. That's what we're looking for, to close that gap. 6 versus 63rd. How do we do that? Looking at concepts like revenue sharing, you know, to help close that so we have better housing, better education, you know, better running water, you know, like potable water, still not in a lot of our communities. You know, so that's why we get so, or I do anyway, I get so passionate about it, is because it's unfinished treaty business. You know? And if we start talking about self-determination and exerting jurisdiction, you know, I would say you can't. I don't like the word self-government. You know, I've always said you can call a beaver a duck, it still won't fly. You know, not until you start looking at self-determination, but as well looking at an economic base for sharing the land and resource wealth, true economic independence. Then you can start setting up your jurisdictions, your own First Nations law over education, health, justice, and everything else. You know, that can happen, but you've got to be economic self-governing, you know, economic independent. It ties in with that. And so this resource revenue sharing is a concept I think that everybody should embrace because it's good for everybody. The business case is clear. Poverty is not acceptable. There's a high social cost. This will address that. That's what I say. That's what I believe. And so there's a constitutional strong foundation for it. Hopefully I've outlined that to you, you know, that there is a legal basis for this, you know, and then that hope that one day we can get to the table where we resolve it. And maybe one day we'll have something like they got in NWT, possibly, you know. But we begin by beginning the dialogue, and that's what this is all about. So thanks very much. I'm going to have questions, okay?
Thank you very kindly, Chief Bellegarden. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. I think this is a very powerful presentation in terms of opening our minds and another way to look at how do we embrace in real policy terms and make a difference and put meaning into the words we're all treaty peoples. So this time we'll do the questions.
Yep.
And take a couple. I guess we start here in Saskatoon. There's a couple of questions. We turn it over to colleagues in Regina for a couple of questions to follow. Question.
Chief Delgar, thank you for the presentation. It was really awesome.
Thank you. The question I have for you is, I think a lot of people in the public may see this as a them versus us issue when it comes to sharing. And I think you've addressed that very clearly in terms of the legal foundations. How can you sort of address it in terms of, you know, sort of the public taxpayer? They always worry that somehow, you know, First Nations people are after their money. How do we address that issue?
That's a really good question, Senator. And it's not an us or them. You know, we're all in this together. You know, it's not that we're going to take all the uranium just for Indians, you know, or all the potash just for Indians. It's not that at all. The principle of sharing, you know, peaceful coexistence and mutual respect, that's a very foundation of treaty. And we are to mutually, both sides benefit from the land and resource wealth, you know. So it's not to take away from Peter to pay Paul, it's not that. But we can clearly demonstrate that one side is benefiting, but the other side isn't. So we just want to be the same standard of life, the same good quality housing. Good quality education for our kids. It's not meant to take away from anybody, but to really share in it. And that's the message we've got to keep getting out. This is not going to hurt our non-Indigenous brothers and sisters if this is done. I think, in fact, it'll probably be more useful because, again, that whole point about poverty, that gets addressed. Because with this system in place, you have better investments in education and home care and housing. You know, so the jails won't be so full of our people. There's a root cause to the whole justice system, you know, which can be traced back to poverty and alcohol and drug abuse, all that. So to me, it's an investment wise, and it's not meant to take away or hurt things. You know, it's to build upon, and we're all supposed to be sharing together, and that's what we got to keep working towards. It's not an us or them. It's we're in this boat together. So that's how I'd answer that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? One in Regina.
Any questions from the audience here?
I'll ask a question. You mentioned the Rainier Company hiring
Aboriginal people. And I'm wondering if you have some other ideas about types of sharing of resource wealth, sharing of wealth in general.
I didn't quite answer the question. What other things besides just the hiring? Was that the question?
That's an example. That's the question.
Yeah. No, there's other things that can happen. And so I give an example like in the Northwest Territories where they're formally sharing in royalties that are generated from the resource wealth. That's going back to the community. That's one way. I also made an earlier point that industry themselves, you know, should have in place, yes, impact benefit agreements, you know, with local communities. Yes, a representative workforce strategy in place within their company. Yes, a procurement policy as well within that company. You know, in terms of a very strategic business case plan within that company that shows how First Nations and Métis people will be engaged, you know. So they can't just unilaterally take the resource without having that strategy in place within their company. So there are some examples, and I use Cameco and I held them up as an example of whereby they're doing good things. You know, BHP, you know, the new potash company in Saskatchewan is doing really good things. You know, they've got a strategy, and the CEO and their management team have embraced the, you know, within their business model that Indigenous peoples, you know, have to be involved, have to be included. We have to incorporate within our business plan, our business model, you know, the inclusion of that strategy because it makes business sense. You know, and that's what has to happen. I think if we start espousing the point that businesses and industry, and it's starting to change, they're not just concerned with that one P being profit. There's two other P's that really have to be embraced, and that's the people and the planet. So it really becomes a 3P strategy, 3P business model that every industry, I would say, not only the public and private sector that have to embrace that, everybody, governments have to embrace that. You know, industry has to embrace that. And that'll be value added. So those things can happen. And it also means, while I'm on this thing, the unions have to get involved. Collective bargaining agreements, you know, have to be reflective of inclusion, you know, of representative workforce strategies at all levels, not just entry-level positions, but middle management and senior management. So even there's a role for unions to get behind a lot of these things as well. So that's my comments. Any other questions?
From Regina or Saskatoon?
Yeah, I have a quick question, and that is, do you see the Northwest Territories deal as a model for Saskatchewan, the 25% revenue sharing? Is that where your discussions are heading in this province?
It could be a model.
It could be a model.
You know, like we're 15% of the population, you know, as First Nations people here, 15% of the royalties, that could be a model. You know, we can hold that up and say, hey, this is working in that jurisdiction. Could it work here? You know, so it could be a start. And remember, I just outlined a legal strategy, but we don't want to use that. You know, if we have to, we will, but let's set up a process and a table and to resolve this. Let's create that economic certainty, because you don't want me going to Standard & Poor's and making a presentation to these bond rating agencies. Why are you giving Saskatchewan a AAA diamond rating here when all the land and resources are stolen from Indian people? And I also have a statement of claim I'm going to file. So instead of a AAA rating, you might have to look at doing it down to a AA rating or even a single one. Well, is that good for anybody? No. So don't make me do that. Let's get to the table. Let's work this out. That's going to be good for everybody.
Mr. Natchez.
Chief Bogart, welcome.
Just wanted you to comment maybe a little bit on the, I know a lot of the students, and we talked about it in one of our classes, the ad that was out not long ago, the advertisement, the TV commercial on resource revenue sharing, where the SAS party was being rather critical of the opposition. Can you speak to that a little bit at all?
Sure, very quickly. Good question. And for some of you that have not seen it, there was I'll call it a racist ad that the SAS party put out, and they slammed the NDP because the NDP in the last provincial election campaigned on resource revenue sharing, right? And so the SAS party took that and utilized that in an ad. And how it affected First Nations people was we were collateral damage with that ad. It promoted a lot more racism, animosity towards Indigenous peoples. And so I publicly addressed that I'm offended by that. It wasn't proper, it wasn't right, you know. And both parties, you know, have not embraced them because even the NDP have retracted now as well on their official party position on resource revenue sharing, you know, because it became a hot item. So it just speaks to me that it's a hot item politically and it becomes polarized. I don't want it to become polarized. That's why I'm here. I want people educated and aware of it. That this is not a bad thing. It's not an us or them. It's not taking away. You know, this is good for the province, good for the country. That's why I took this opportunity to come here to all you policymakers here in the future, you know, to embrace it. It's not an us or them. So that ad was, pretty racist. So I addressed that. You know, but it's interesting to note, you know, that both the NDP have retracted from it, you know. And whether you call it resource revenue sharing or resource benefit sharing, or greater strategies for involvement in the economy, however you want to name it or label it, it's something that has to get addressed because it's just a business case that can be made. And it's really, it creates economic certainty and it really addresses that whole issue of poverty. So that's my comments on that piece. There was another question in the back.
Not a question, it's more like a comment. When you go back in history, just something I need to, and I've done some research, that happened way before the Royal Proclamation of 1763. Mm-hmm. And when the Northwest Territories was opened up to the fur industry, and May 8, 1715, was a treaty agreement, a trade agreement between the Dene and the Cree. Facilitated by the Hudson Bay manager in northern Saskatchewan. Once that agreement was in place, the fur industry opened up and created Canada. So when First Nations are involved amongst themselves to do benefit for them, for the industry, it'll help the nation as a whole, and that's what built Canada. This agreement happened right before 1763, and it's documented in the Hudson Bay archives. You'll see it there.
Thanks. That's a good piece. We could use that in our claim. I have to research that, Don. You know, that's a good, like, when it comes to these things, you, like, learn and grow all the time, you know? And that speaks to even creating treaties amongst ourselves as Indigenous peoples, you know? We didn't just have treaties with the Crown. We had treaties amongst ourselves, you know, so that can foster trade and even to keep peace between the Bloods and the Blackfoot and the Cree. There's a treaty as well, so it speaks to that.
So probably a couple more questions.
This was a very interesting presentation. You drew a number of distinctions at the beginning, and I wonder how some of those might relate to the model of resource revenue sharing that you see as optimal in terms of the policy. So do you envision shares for both First Nations and Métis communities?
Sure.
And do you see it as something that's a share at the level of the individual rights-bearing community or something claimed at the FSIN level or somewhere in between when you spoke of agencies and tribal councils? Where do you see that claim as being best pursued?
It's a really good question. Really good question. Because AFN, all my chart over here, aren't rights holders. AFN's not a rights and title holder. FSIN's not a rights and title holder. tribal councils aren't rights and title holder. It's the chiefs and council, the people, are the rights and title holder, right? So it would have to rest there. You know, it would have to rest there. So that if we were to look at a revenue sharing model, it would go to each First Nations community on behalf of all their total membership. That's how that should be looked at. And we still have to look at the framework, how that could be looked at, you know. But it would also, it should be inclusive of the Métis people as well. But that's something else down the road to work out, you know. It'll be easier on the First Nations side, you know, because we have a very clearly defined structure, very clearly defined membership as well in each reserve, you know. So that's where it would rest, because you have, it's a whole issue of individual rights, you know. And I've said this before, we see the trend now that individual rights are starting to supersede the collective rights of the people. You have individual rights and you have collective rights, you know. And this is a dialogue debate for another time, you know. For example, I don't want a piece of land on Black Bear. I don't own 1 acre of land. Nobody does. It's the collective rights, collective title to that territory, right? In some instances, people are starting to toy with, well, why can't I own that 1 acre? Why can't I own that 1 acre? Fee simple title. We have to be very careful of that in that instance, you know, because it takes away from the collective rights of the people as indigenous peoples, you know. And so, very good question. It rests back in where the rights and title holder are, is with the people in the membership. Okay?
One last question. Is there any from Regina?
No, I think we're good.
Okay. All good?
All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Well, we've got, on behalf of Junshu Sharma, Graduate School of Public Policy, is a token of our thanks for sharing your experience, your wisdom, your vision, and enlightening us on a very important public policy issue in this province.
All right. Thank you, Chief. Thank you so much. Thank you again.